Chapter 31, King Ahab and His Wicked Queen. Of all the 19 kings of Israel, Ahab, the son of Omri, lived a life the most stirring and eventful. He and his notorious queen Jezebel stand out in the nation's history above all other kings and queens as doers of evil. But we cannot say that Ahab himself was worse than several others, and he was a shrewd and able ruler. His introduction to us is as a bridegroom when he, the king of Israel, was taking for his queen the daughter of Ethbaal, king of Phoenicia. It is possible that the marriage had been arranged by his father Omri, but even thus we feel sure that the young prince of Israel was very willing to wed this bold, dashing, and masterful daughter of idolatry. His whole attitude towards her as queen tells us as much. Both Ahab and his father could have given good reasons why such a marriage was for the welfare of the kingdom. Israel was already in the power of Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, and without some strong ally, the future was uncertain. To be connected with a country like Phoenicia would be a great advantage. Its capital, Tyre, where Jezebel had lived, was a wide-awake city, and very much in advance of Samaria in worldly culture and comforts. When simple, pastoral Israel should come in touch with a city of such large trade interests, new ideas and ambitions would rise in the people, and progress would be the result. It all came to pass. Queen Jezebel appeared in Samaria as a lady of fashion with a large following, showing the splendors of a Phoenician court. The marketplace had never before displayed such costly merchandise, exquisite wearing apparel, and rich tapestries and hangings for house furnishings, and a time of luxury followed. We know this from the character of Tyre, and especially from the queen herself, to the last scene of her life. This strong-minded woman at once got the more yielding Ahab under her influence. To please her, he built a house for Baal in the capital and erected an altar for his worship. The Phoenician goddess, Ashtoreth, was equally honored. No expense was spared to make their worship attractive and imposing. At the queen's table sat 450 priests of Baal and 400 of Ashtoreth. When all these priests were engaged in their idol worship, twisting their bodies in a fantastic way, while their weird chanting and wild shrieking filled the air, the whole must have been spectacular. It is easy to understand the indignation and horror of the few simple, devout Israelites when they looked on such frenzy. The indulgent king tolerated all this for his queen's sake, and he may have taken to the idea that if one god was a security, many gods would be a stronger protection. But he soon learned his mistake. Ben-Hadad, who had defeated King Omri, was strong and insolent. His nation had grown to size and strength, while Israel had remained a small world power. Made bold by this unequal strength, Ben-Hadad picked a quarrel with Ahab and then ordered his army to set themselves in array. The outlook was dark to Ahab and his small army. What chance had he against such a host? Just when he needed encouragement, a prophet appeared before him. "Thus saith Jehovah, hast thou seen all this great multitude? Behold, I will deliver it into thy hand this day, and thou shalt know that I am Jehovah," he said. "By whom?" questioned Ahab. "By the young men of the princes of the provinces," answered the prophet. Ahab was all attention, and it was with eager interest that he asked, "Who shall begin the battle?" When the answer came, "Thou," he at once began preparations. Following the prophet's command, he first mustered the 232 young men and sent them out so as to reach the Syrian camp by noon. Ahab well knew that in the heat of the day, the dissipated Syrian king would be drinking with his kings and in the worst possible state for battle. Word came in to the drunken king and his royal company that a little band of men had come from Samaria. A shout of derision must have gone up from the pavilions at the appearance of such a handful to face the warring hosts of Syria. "Take them alive, whether in peace or war," commanded the intoxicated monarch. Perhaps in his confused mind, this appeared like a royal joke, but the result he found to be serious. It seems probable that the whole army was in a drunken state. The few young Hebrews valiantly slew them right and left, and the Syrian army became confused and were put to rout. The body of the army of Israel came up, and though it numbered only 7,000 men, the Syrian disaster was complete. Ben-Hadad himself, by this time quite sober, escaped on horseback, a very humble king. This was truly a splendid victory for Ahab and his small army, but he was not allowed to rest on his laurels. The same prophet came again and said impressively, "Go strengthen thyself, and mark, and see what thou doest, for at the return of the year the king of Syria will come up against thee." On the other hand, Ben-Hadad's subjects ventured to approach him with comfort and counsel. His army was defeated because the battle was fought in the hills where the God of Israel dwells, they said, while the Syrian God is of the plains. But with an army of equal strength, a battle fought on the plains would give Syria the victory. Then the wise men of war advised that the weak kings be removed from the army and real captains be made generals. The next year saw Ahab again facing the Syrian host, and the same difference in the size of the armies was evident. This time, the battlefield was the great historic plain of Aphek, where both Gideon and Saul had fought memorable battles. The Bible gives a vivid picture of the armies of Israel and Syria, and the children of Israel encamped before them like two little flocks of kids, but the Syrians filled the country. Ahab must have trembled before this immense multitude of Syria. At the right time, the prophet again came and assured him that this great army was to be overthrown, and he and his two little flocks would be victorious. For a whole week, the armies encamped near together before the battle began. They seemed to be watching each other and fearing to make an attack. After the terrible engagement was over, 100,000 Syrians lay dead on the plain. The rest fled to the city of Aphek, where a fresh disaster met them. A wall, perhaps a hastily made fortification, gave way and crushed 27,000 Syrians. Ben-Hadad could not have been in a worse position. With the blind impulse to hide from the enemy, he fled from chamber to chamber in the city, till he came into an inner chamber, where he was as good as imprisoned and at the mercy of Ahab. In this desperate strait, the Syrian king acted on an unusual plan suggested by his officers. They advised him to appeal to the mercy of the king of Israel. Accordingly, those servants with sackcloth on their loins and ropes on their heads, in token of distress and humiliation, came before Ahab and meekly said to the king, "Thy servant Ben-Hadad saith, I pray thee, let me live." Circumstances had changed since Ben-Hadad sent his threatening messages to the vassal king of Israel. It was now in Ahab's power to return this insolence, but instead, this easily moved king gave the surprising return. "Is he yet alive? He is my brother." The astonished officers, to make sure that they had heard right, and to follow up any possible advantage, ventured to add, "Thy brother Ben-Hadad? Go ye, bring him," the king commanded. It must have been a very distressed and uncertain Ben-Hadad who approached Ahab. What could be his intention? Would he have him killed outright? But Ahab greeted him as a brother king and took him up in his chariot. The wily Syrian at once began to make great promises. "The cities which my father took from thy father I will restore, and thou shalt make streets for thee in Damascus as my father made in Samaria." Ahab was in good spirits. He forgot entirely that it was the Lord who had given him this victory over a great heathen power. He took it upon himself to treat with this enemy as he liked. It was not in God's plan that Ahab should accept the treacherous Syrian for as a brother and make a loose treaty with him. When the enemy was again out of reach, he could keep or break it. King Ahab was on his triumphal return to Samaria when a prophet, disguised, with his headband over his eyes, called to him from the wayside. It is possible that he had seen the sudden friendship, and his prophetic soul beheld trouble to come of it. To the king, flushed with victory, he revealed how this weak treaty with a false enemy would bring destruction on both Israel and her king. Ahab continued on his way, but the glow of triumph had left him. He entered Samaria, heavy and displeased. But Ahab's last undertaking was at hand, and the end was nearly in sight. For his really good qualities, he had been given a long trial. He was genial and generous, and without doubt had lovable traits. The great pity was that he was so easily influenced, and that his directing spirit was the fanatical queen. The marriage of Ahab's daughter Athaliah to Jehoshaphat's son Jehoram was undoubtedly to strengthen their kingdoms, and later Jehoshaphat made Ahab a friendly visit. We can easily imagine that Ahab and Jezebel were splendid entertainers. The Bible account that Ahab killed sheep and oxen for him in abundance and for the people that were with him tells us that he set before his guests a royal banquet. Just at the right moment, when the royal company felt pleased with themselves and all the world, Ahab brought up the subject of their common enemy, Syria. He showed Jehoshaphat how Ben-Hadad had broken the loose treaty after the Second Syrian War by refusing to give up the stronghold Ramoth-Gilead. Then he unfolded his plan of capturing the city and asked for his friend's assistance. The king of Judah was a guest, and his courtly host was of the same race and people. His polite reply, "I am as thou art, my people as thy people, my horses as thy horses," sounds very much like a promise. If so, he recalled it at once by asking that first the will of the Lord be learned regarding the undertaking. A memorable scene followed. The two kings, arrayed in royal robes, were sitting each on his throne in an open place near the gate of Samaria. Before them stood 400 prophets summoned by Ahab. "Shall I go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear?" the king asked them. "Go up, for the Lord will deliver it into the hands of the king," was the glib reply of those time servers. Ahab was delighted, but his guest was not entirely satisfied with the appearance of these men. "Is there not a prophet of Jehovah besides?" he asked. Ahab reluctantly called in one he hated, Micaiah, because he was not afraid to tell the king the unpleasant truth. When this fearless prophet was asked the same question, he would promise nothing but defeat. King Ahab, in a great rage, sent him to prison and began at once his preparations for war. As for Jehoshaphat, his word had been given, and he could not withdraw with one voice against 400. In the fatal attack against Ramoth-Gilead, Jehoshaphat had a narrow escape, and Ahab was struck by a chance arrow. The battle raged furiously, and all day long the mortally wounded king sat propped up in his chariot, bravely encouraging his soldiers. About sunset, Ahab died. And at the same hour a cry went up throughout all the hosts of Israel, "Every man to his city, and every man to his country." The king's body was brought to Samaria, and the gruesome prophecy of Elijah was verified. The chariot, in which the wounded king had sat all day, was washed in the pool of Samaria, and the dogs lipped up his blood.